Good evening, dear listeners, and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., that means WDIY presents Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, John Pierce. Working the board for us this evening, Neil Heaver, our Director of Operations here at WDIY. Oh, it's History Night this evening. Those of you who love history, and particularly the U.S. Revolution, will love this one because my guest is Andrew Zellers Frederick, who has been with us before. This is the second time here, Andy, and I'm glad to have you come back.
John, thank you for having me again. It's most appreciated.
Yes, sir. Andy has, as far as his studies are concerned, had graduated cum laude from Temple University with a Bachelor of Arts in History, and from LaSalle University with a Master of Arts in History with academic honors. And Andy, that must seem like another life, huh? Way in the past?
Actually, not that long ago. I got my master's a little bit later in life. I went back, and I also have a degree in historic preservation, which was fun doing that.
Oh, wow.
So, but it does seem like another life.
Yeah. Well, you think back about being a student, and now you've done so many things since then. In fact, Andy was a park ranger, volunteer program coordinator for the National Park Service in Philadelphia. He was historical marketing researcher for the Franklin Mint in Franklin Center. I didn't know there was a town called Franklin Center.
Well, there was when the Mint was located there.
All right.
They had their own post office, and it was like their own campus and a warehouse and that huge building out on Route 1, which now is empty, or it's not being used to its potential. The Mint pulled out quite a while ago, but yet they're still a company. They are still selling product.
But they no longer have an address called Franklin.
No, no longer Franklin Center. I think their address now is in nearby Media.
All right, yeah, the suburbs. And Andy has taught at Bucks County Community College in Newtown for a couple of years, and he's been librarian from 2010 to the present at the David Library of the American Revolution in Washington Crossing. I know, Andy, that you love this library. So tell our folks about what they would find at the David Library.
Well, let me first tell you, I've been going there for over 30 years. It opened in the early 80s. The way I found it was I was just driving down Route 32, River Road, in Washington's Crossing, and they had a little sign. And I backed up and sort of take a look at that. And, you know, this is before the internet or anything else, and it was the best kept secret. The facilities have over 9,000 books and assorted things, 10,000 reels of microfilm, pamphlets, brochures.
Wait a minute. How many reels?
Over 10,000.
That's unbelievable.
Yes. It used to be you had to go to London for a lot of this material. Now they've got it. Uh-huh. So you could look up, let's say you wanted to check a newspaper in Philadelphia in 1776. You can look it up there. And Philadelphia had 7 newspapers. So
now this is the David Library.
Yes.
In Washington Crossing.
Yes.
Is it uniquely dealing with our revolution?
Yes. It goes from about 1750 to just about the starting days of the Republic.
And so you've been associated there for 30 years plus.
Yep.
And recently, what did you do there?
Recently, I like to do articles about subjects that, well, could be obscure, and these are all from the Revolution, or maybe they sound a little fishy to me, the way that they've been written up. And I just did an article that was published by the Journal of the American Revolution, which anybody can get if you go online and Google Journal of the American Revolution. It's free, on General Thomas Conway. And if your listeners have heard of the Conway Cabal, the plot to remove Washington as commander-in-chief, this is one of the gentlemen that was involved with it. And after he left America, after he was sort of disgraced and also shot in a duel, our books write him off and say he died in 1800 in obscurity and penniless in Ireland. Well, I researched and found out that wasn't the case. Died in 1795 in Bath, England. He's buried under the floor of the Abbey there. And he also managed to get the rank of general in the British Army. He was a governor of French India at one point. This is all after the Revolution, so he did not fade.
And this is, again, this is Conway.
Yes, this is Conway, yes.
So, since you mentioned the Journal of the American Revolution, let me mention to our listeners other publications in which you have, to which you have contributed. The American Revolution, an encyclopedia. You have numerous entries in that one. Delaware History, Delaware Historical Society Journal. Military History Magazine, so you're into military history as well.
Yes, very much.
A Journal of Historic Rittenhouse Town and the Pennsylvania Freemason. What did they do with the Pennsylvania Freemason? What kinds
of... Well, I was director for almost 5 years of the museum, the Pennsylvania Masonic Museum and Library down in Center City, Philadelphia, right across from Philadelphia City Hall. And the fraternal organization, we were the museum, publishes a magazine usually 5 times a year, 6 times a year. And as director of the museum and library, I was expected to write an article of something to do with the museum and masonry. And so I faithfully did those articles. And they were all historical. And again, most of them were about Masons and the Revolution. Because almost everybody on every side was a Mason, including Washington.
Interesting, yes. So Andrew Zellers Frederick is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're talking about the U.S. Revolution. Do you prefer the term American Revolution instead of U.S.?
I think that's pretty customary to use American Revolution,
yes,
or War of Independence.
Okay.
I think in Europe I found they tend to drift to War of Independence. Here we do American Revolution.
Right. Yeah, one of the interesting things from our standpoint, when as I studied U.S. history as a school child and got my feet wet in that, and then I went to college and had a course on English history. And so with England having to deal with European powers, and here come the North American colonies to muddle up and make a mess for England, it gives you a different perspective.
Right. Well, all history, you know, is related. I mean, everything ties together at some point. What's going on in Europe, and you mentioned Great Britain during this period, is affecting the revolution. It's affecting the way the British are fighting it.
How much money they have to spread around.
Right, you know,
and how
being able to send the troops. Right. And then it becomes a world war with the French, Spanish, and Dutch fighting the British along with us. So all are interconnected. And that's what's fascinating when you read about it. Another article I'm working on now is one on John Paul Jones. And everybody's heard of John Paul Jones.
Yeah, sure.
You know, he didn't give up. He fought, you know, a huge naval battle with the British. Well, one thing he did was he's the first person to have invaded England in the last 200 years. He decided to land in this town called Whitehaven on the Irish Sea. And he actually grew up there. And so he was familiar with it, and he knew it was a major port, and there were always hundreds of ships there. He's deciding he's going to attack the town, land with his sailors, capture the garrison, burn all the ships, and make England pay, because England's doing the same thing on our coast, burning ports and things, especially up in New England. And the raid wasn't the most successful. He managed to burn one ship. The crew got fairly intoxicated. They found a local pub, and you can guess what happened.
Yeah, what's there not to like about those pubs over
there? Yeah. And then, but it wasn't what he physically did. It's the effect it had on England, that it drove their insurance rates sky high. The British had to recall ships from North America to protect their home waters. So in the long term, it was a successful raid. So that's what I'm writing about, because you don't see that much about it.
Well, I see that you do have that interest in military history. As a matter of fact, as we have studied history through the years many times, we've been limited to presidents, kings, heads of state, and military battles.
Yeah.
And now history is much wider than that. We do medical history. We do history of women. We do many things. It used to be also that we concentrated on U.S. and Europe more. Mm-hmm. If you're going into a history department, well, do you teach European history or do you teach U.S. history? Whereas now you have Latin American and you have Asian and African all over the globe.
It's so unfortunate that right now there are the history departments in various universities have really been reduced. People are concerned about getting employment. I've been lucky that I've been employed in my field, but sometimes that's few and far between. And there's really two paths to take with history. I mean, main paths, you go into teaching or you go into what I did with museums and historic sites and research, and you try to make a living on it. And I can't tell you how many times people have said to me when I've told them what I've done, they say, oh, you're a history buff.
Yes.
And I have to turn and say, no, I'm a history professional. I actually need to make a living off of this.
Right, right. Because many of us are buffs, but we don't have the expertise. We don't have the – we have not dug as deeply as you have to be a history professional.
It's funny you should say dug. I've also done archaeology. So.
Oh, all right.
That's also brought into the mixture.
All right. Now, would you prefer to be a full-time archaeologist as opposed to a full-time historian? How do you judge that?
No, I think that's past with my age. If you look at my high school yearbook from Central High in Philadelphia, it says archaeologist. After I did the one dig and I've seen digs and visited them, I much prefer not to be in the hot sun and everything. I was very lucky when I worked for Colonial Williamsburg. That we had an outpost at historic Jamestown, which I hope a lot of people remember is the site of the first colony, permanent colony in the New World of England from 1607. Well, I got to work with the archaeologists because I was raising money for the program. Colonial Williamsburg was affiliated with them, and got to meet Dr. Bill Kelso, who is a legend. If you saw him, you would think he was Indiana Jones. And whenever there was a major discovery down at Jamestown, I would get a phone call up in Williamsburg, and I would be down there in like 20 minutes and get to see what they were uncovering. And I even was told of when they discovered there and could prove there had been cannibalism at Jamestown during the starving time. And they found the evidence, but they kept it quiet for 10 months because we didn't know how we were going to release that. And I would be talking about it, the archaeologists, the guides. So we spent 10 months working with the Smithsonian and making sure all our T's were crossed, all our I's were dotted. And I broke the news when I was at giving a talk for the Daughters of the American Revolution. And they had heard through the grapevine that there was going to be a big announcement that day down in Williamsburg. And as soon as I started to talk, they put their hands up and said, can you tell us? And this is 10 o'clock. I said, ask me at 11:30 and I can tell you.
Where did you give that talk for the DAR?
It was in Williamsburg.
In Williamsburg.
Yeah.
What a fabulous place that is. I hope that all of our listeners at some point in their lives will go to Williamsburg. Rockefeller money.
Yeah,
right?
Well, it was. The Rockefellers still contribute, but not the money that was given by John Rockefeller back in the 1920s. I think the total figure was $38 million, and in today's dollars, that's billions.
Yes.
And he made it possible. Again, like history is suffering in schools, it's also suffering at Williamsburg. The Bicentennial, they had over a million visitors. Now they're barely scraping by at 600,000, which still sounds like a lot.
It does.
But if you consider everything they maintain, everything they have to do, they've got to raise money just like anybody else now. They go out to foundations and corporations and things like that, and they've been forced to cut staff quite a bit.
Oh, that's a shame.
That's actually what I should mention happened to me. My program was ended at Jamestown, so with it went my position.
Now, just a question of trivia here. Do you spell Jamestown with an E on the end of it?
Depends on what it's used in. There is no rhyme or reason. The Park Service does one. There are three Jamestowns. There's the Park Service site. There's the site that I work down, which is Historic Jamestown, which is owned by the Historic or Virginia Preservation Virginia, actually. And then there's the state site, which everybody knows because it has the three ships.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
Funny, the state site, which is one of the biggest, nothing historical happened there.
Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, those are the things that you think of with Jamestown. I did not know that there were three different Jamestowns. And one of them spells with an E on the end,
yes.
And the others do not?
Yes.
Oh.
But the site that I would recommend to your listeners is the See Historic Jamestown, the one with the archaeologist. Because if you go from the spring, from about March till October, you can see a live dig. They're out there working, and you might get lucky enough to be there when they find something. You'll know it because they call everybody in, and Dr. Kelso comes out, and they start probing and looking.
Wow.
Funny story, they had President Bush was coming, the son, George Bush, the son was coming for the 400th anniversary, and the archaeologists were working, and they had uncovered some pieces of swords, the hilts. And they're, you know, gently taking them out, and he's there. And he looked, and he said, oh, you just put them there for my sake to make it look good. And they said, no, we just found them. And
just happened to be right when he was there.
Yeah, they were.
That's exciting.
Yeah, and Dr. Kelso also got to take the queen around, and he had 20, 25 minutes with her alone, which nobody gets.
Oh.
And he said her face lit up when he said this was the birthplace of the British Empire.
I said, this is 2007.
2007, yeah.
Okay. Jamestown,
yeah.
Virginia. Yes, indeed. So all this experience that Andrew Zellers Frederick, my guest, has had through the years, he was director of Historic Jamestown Fund for the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation in Williamsburg. And we must take a break at this point, Andy, and invite our listeners to hang in there. And after a very short break, we will be back. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails. Discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 7 or wdiy.org. Thank you.
Well, it's very good to have Andrew Zellers Frederick return to our microphones here at WDIY to talk to us about the American Revolution, which is his passion. That's a fair statement, right?
I think so. Everybody asks me, well, how did you get involved with this? And it's pretty easy. I can identify. When I was around 9, maybe 8, my parents made a special effort to take us out when there was a holiday or a weekend to Washington's Crossing, to Valley Forge, Gettysburg. That was a little bit out of the Revolution, but, you know, sites like that. And I soon got a very strong appreciation for the American Revolution. My sister, on the other hand, hated it. And to this day, doesn't like history at all.
What did she wind up doing?
My sister is teaching preschool, but she was very into sports. which is something I don't have the coordination for.
Okay.
Or at least not well. I can fence. That's about it.
How do you do as far as playing the fife?
Not at all. I play the piano.
Okay. Well, that's terrific.
And I did play for a year, believe it or not, the concert harp.
Oh. So you're into music as well as history.
I like classical music.
Beautiful. Let's talk a little bit about the roundtable. Andy, I think of you as Mr. Roundtable because you have been involved in several of them. First of all, let's explain what a roundtable is.
Okay, a roundtable, I should mention there's probably about 30 to 35 of them, mostly on the East Coast. It's a place to get together for, it doesn't have to be scholars, it doesn't have to be historians, it can be anybody that is curious to come and talk about the American Revolution. Generally at meetings, the roundtables have a speaker, whether it be an author, whether it be a scholar, whether it be someone to talk about a project. They were restoring a building from the time of the Revolution. I've heard all different types. The roundtable here in the Lehigh Valley, which I started in December of 2015, making the announcement for it and such, was actually the grandchild of the roundtable in Richmond, Virginia. Because that Richmond, Virginia has one with 400 people in it.
Oh, wow. That's,
now,
that's huge.
There's no set rule on how you run these. I mean, we have bylaws and we have officers, but it's not a rigid organization. So the one in Richmond actually does a dinner with theirs. So they get 300 to 400 people coming.
What I'm trying to visualize, Andy, is Richmond having a room large enough for a round table to seat 400 people.
They do it at one of the colleges down there. So I guess they use their facilities for catering and then go into another room for speaking. But then we decided, I was living in Williamsburg at the time, that it was 65 miles to drive to Richmond, and on the interstate, it wasn't always pleasant. So why couldn't we have one in the historic triangle? Yorktown, Williamsburg, and Jamestown. And so a group of us got together, stole what we could from Richmond, you know, for setting up, and started with about a dozen people or so. Now they're up to about 50 people, and they're still meeting. When I came here to Easton, I was surprised to find out there wasn't one for the Revolution yet.
In the whole Lehigh Valley.
In the whole Lehigh Valley, or even across the river, you know, over in Jersey. The closest one was in Morristown. So being the director of the local museum at the time, I suggested that we do it and we be the sponsor to start it off. And thanks to this radio station, I was here. We announced it. We gave the address where to go, and we had 30 people come out for the first meeting.
Terrific.
And we average about 20 for a meeting, unless it's a really spectacular speaker, and then that draws people in. For members, coming to the meetings are free. If you're just coming to hear the speaker, we ask for a small donation because that helps us get the speakers.
You have memberships, too.
Yes, we have memberships. Membership is $25 a year.
Okay, very modest. And let's give some information how a person would get in touch with Roundtable if he or she wanted to join.
Okay, if you want to visit our website, it's www.lvarrt.org. And that'll have events, it'll have programs, it'll sometimes have recordings of talks that we've given and such. If you want to email us and request specific information, that's easy to do. It's lehighvalleyarrt@gmail.com. Or you can even call. I have one phone that I use for the roundtable, and people are welcome to call. They always do. It's 215-904-2344. And happy to tell you what our next speakers are going to be or programs. We not only have talks, lectures, whatever, we've also taken one, you want to call it a field trip, everybody wanted to go to the David Library of the American Revolution. So we went down there on a Saturday and had a VIP tour.
Terrific. Yes. I love field trips. I've always loved field trips for classes, for whatever group you happen to be affiliated with.
We want to go, I think, next year to the new museum down in Philadelphia on the Revolution.
Yeah, and that museum is only a couple of years old.
It just opened a little over a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll be 2 years in April mm-hmm. for its anniversary. And it's funny, I used to work right there. You know, that's in the national park.
Right. Now, have you been to that new museum?
I have to admit, not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
I haven't had called to go down to Center City, Philadelphia. You know, it's a little bit of a haul from Easton.
That's going home for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I have my family on the suburbs around Philadelphia, so I go there. But I intend to go down. I know all the people that administer it, and they want me to come down. So,
sure.
But maybe I'll just wait for when we go on a tour and be surprised. There's also another great Revolutionary War museum. It's primarily on Yorktown because it is at Yorktown. But that's brand new, and that's right in the Yorktown area. So you see the two, you've really covered the Revolution.
Great. And these are two of the outstanding museums in the whole country.
Yes.
On the Revolution.
Yes.
Now, I'm guessing that museums and libraries having to do with our Revolution are more prominent in the on the eastern part of the U.S. than farther west. Is that?
Yeah, well, you know, the Revolution was fought in Kentucky and in Ohio and Illinois. So I think there might be one among them. But you're right. Most of them are on the East Coast.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Geographically.
There's one in Philadelphia. There's one in Valley Forge. You can... Major centers where the Revolution occurred or there was colonial history is where they're at.
Right. So it's the American Revolution that we're talking about this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. My guest, Andrew Zellers Frederick. He has a passion for this subject, which is very obvious. You talk to him, and just the fact that you have created these roundtables, because that's a big initiative to take and a risk. You don't know at the new area where you're moving, is there enough interest for this to happen? Were you able to sound out enough people here in the Lehigh Valley to figure out this might work?
I did, because there are revolutionary reenactment groups around this area. You see them on Heritage Day in Easton and all, and we have several of those people in our organization. So I knew there would be an interest. I'm hoping we get a lot more people, because the more people we get to attend and become members, we can get bigger names, scholars, historians, authors to come and speak to us. We have a wonderful facility. We meet at Lafayette College at their OECHLS Center for Global Education, room 101. It's located at 53 South College Drive. And we try to meet on the third Wednesday every other month. So we start with January, and then would be March, and then May, and so forth, and even through this summer. We do change it sometimes when we have an opportunity to get a really good speaker, and it's not convenient for them, so we might jump back to the second or the fourth. I know last year in November, we weren't going to go the night before Thanksgiving.
Right.
So nobody would have come out, so we went to the second Wednesday. But we announce all that on the website, and we send notices out. We have a distribution list that people can get on. You can request to be put on that.
Do you have a structure with an executive committee?
We have a board.
A board. And they meet then not on general meeting nights, but at other
not
times?
Not usually. Sometimes if we need a short meeting, the officers get together after the talk or before. So, you know, we're not coming out twice, because some of them don't live in Easton. They come a little bit of a distance. One of our board members lives in Upper Blackaddy, so a little bit of a haul for him. One lives in Doylestown.
Okay. You mentioned Heritage Day in Easton. Explain to us what that is. That's just after the 4th of July.
Right? Yes, it's on July the 8th. Well, that's the anniversary. They do it on the Sunday closest to it. It's one of the times when the Declaration of Independence was read for the first time. It was read in Philadelphia, obviously. It was read the same day in Trenton and in Easton. So that's what we're commemorating.
And it was read on the 8th of July for the first time in those three
places. In those three places, yes.
Interesting. And I've heard that the easy thing to do is to declare independence. The difficult part is the Constitution. The devil is in the details, right?
Well, look, it's still governing us today.
Yes, exactly.
And it's open to interpretation. Right now, we're going through a lot of that, so it is relevant. I've had a course in the Constitution and know it pretty well. I interpret it sometimes a lot differently than what some things go on today.
The Supreme Court?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's the remarkable thing about our government, that this same document is governing us over two centuries later.
Correct.
And that we might dispute it. It's very, very difficult to amend it.
Yes, intentionally so.
Intentionally, yeah.
Right. So in order to amend the Constitution, 3/4 of the states have to agree. Do they take that to the legislatures of the states for approval?
Yes.
Okay.
Generally.
Right. And then Congress has to be in on it too. Mm-hmm. Is it a majority of Congress?
I think it's... right now I'm not sure because we've changed the majorities. It used to be it's now a simple majority. It used to be you had to have 3/4. So I'd have to brush up on that and see what it is. As far as I know, there are no amendments in the pipeline, though they've talked about. Again, it's very, very difficult. And it's very, very difficult to abolish an amendment, such as when prohibition.
Yes.
That was one of the ones that went in.
So the way we abolished it was 18th Amendment, prohibition, 21st Amendment. Now we didn't think that was such a good idea, right? So we have two amendments in there. You know who this would drive crazy? The French. Every time they have a new government, let's go back to World War II, and then they start having their first, second, third, fourth, fifth. De Gaulle was the fifth government, so to speak, it's a new constitution. And as somebody said, well, 95% of it is the same as it was, but they consider the document to be harmonious only if it's created at that time and not have all these amendments. We're doing it a different way in our country.
We very much wanted to have a government different from Britain. Though there were advocates that we should adopt the same structure, Alexander Hamilton was a big promoter of that. But mostly everybody felt that we were a new nation. We needed something new. And the convention was very interesting. We had a document governing us during the Revolution called the Articles of Confederation. And what it effectively did was create 13 independent countries. So Pennsylvania had its own constitution and Virginia and sent out its own ambassadors, its own navy. Though there was a Congress, it was very weak. No power to tax, to create a central government. And by the 1780s, the mid-1780s, America was falling apart. And this convention was called merely to amend the articles. What could they do to strengthen them? And I used to shock people when I gave programs in Independence Hall and say, well, they got here, decided that there was nothing to save, and abolished the official government of the United States, effectively overthrew it, and created a new one with the Constitutional Convention.
That's interesting. One of the differences, in fact, a huge difference between Britain and the U.S. as far as this constitutional business, is we have a constitution that's actually written down.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been something that loyalists would have thought, no, we don't need that because the Brits got theirs for centuries, got along okay. without writing things down so much.
It's funny you bring up loyalists. It's a particular interest of mine. I like viewing the revolution from the other perspective. And, you know, the estimates are a little off. John Adams said 1/3 of the population were ardent patriots, 1/3 were loyal to the crown, and 1/3 kind of sat on the fence waiting to see who was going to win. It probably was more there were patriots, but still there was a substantial number of loyalists that didn't want to change and recognize Great Britain and felt, why do we need to rebel? We're protected by the greatest power on earth. So, you know, a lot of the loyalists left. That's why Canada has a different government than we do. And they're very proud of their loyalists. If you go to New Brunswick or Nova Scotia, their core, their founders were all American loyalists.
Right. And under the Queen, correct?
Under the Queen, yes.
Yes. Loyalty to the Queen. Andrew Zellers Frederick is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're talking about the American Revolution and events around it, like the formation of our country. I think it's really interesting to think that the 13 colonies finally came together, but it was messy for a while, and they didn't know exactly what kind of a confederation they should have.
Well, remember, one of the big issues they had on the Declaration was slavery.
Yes,
and
indeed.
The South was not going to sign the Declaration if they went with, you know, the premise that all men are created equal and the slaves would be freed and given rights. And so they had to abandon that and compromise, which we paid for later on in the Civil War. That solved it once and for all. Even, you know, the Constitutional Convention had to wrestle with it. And the northern states abandoned it by the beginning to mid-19th century because they found it was more efficient, less costly to pay a wage to people. But the South, it was their peculiar institution.
Right.
And
yeah, it has been a thorn in the side ever since slaves were brought over here.
Yeah, and in some respects, there are still things going on in certain areas of the country. And we're feeling it still.
It's time for us to take another break here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host. Neil Heaver is doing our engineering. He is our Director of Operations here at WDIY. So pleased to have you join us this evening. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY offers many choices and real voices.
This is Martin Richter. Join me and our other hosts each weekday from 9 to noon for WDIY Classics, medieval to baroque, romantic to modern, along with concert information and artist interviews.
WDIY is the Lehigh Valley's local source for NPR news, public affairs, and diverse music at 88.1 FM and streaming on WDIY.org.
And we're back talking about the American Revolution with Andrew Zellers Frederick. Andrew, let's give some information once more. If somebody would like to get in touch with you, you're available for speeches, for talks.
I am. I have done it all through the Lehigh Valley. I've done it down in Philadelphia. I did it in the Williamsburg area. They can call me at 215-904-2344 or get in touch with me with the roundtable at LehighValleyArrt@gmail.com.
Very good. Andrew, I want to ask you a question. I've heard that back you were talking about, was it John Adams who said there was a third of the people?
Yes.
This and that. That some of the, I presume some of the loyalists wanted us to have a king and would like for George Washington to take the crown. Now, is that accurate as far as you
know? I don't know. I think the loyalists wanted to keep George III. That was their rightful king, their anointed king. There were people among the patriots that wanted to make George Washington, in effect, a president for life.
Being a very strong president.
Yes, yes. And Washington very wisely rejected that immediately. But he had been the centerpiece of the revolution, and people looked at them and they thought, well, why not? Right. Washington is a remarkable figure that at the end of the war, he turned in his commission. He had that whole army behind him. He could have done something. And he turned it in at Annapolis to the Congress. Then when he was president, after his second term, people wondered if he was going to give it up. And he smoothly did it, set the precedent that you hold two terms. Wasn't until FDR that changed, and was made an amendment.
Right.
But they're interesting. When I worked in Congress Hall, next to Independence Hall, we talked about that moment. And Washington was there for the inauguration of John Adams. And both of them, after it was done, wanted Washington to precede them, to go out the door. And he said, no, I'm just a regular citizen now. That's probably not the words, but right. In effect, that's what he said. You're the president and the vice president. You should precede me.
Terrific.
And George III even said, if Washington gives up the power, he'll be one of the most remarkable men in history.
Interesting. George III said that.
Yeah.
Wow. George III wasn't ready to abdicate, was he?
He never did.
No.
He was one of the longest reigning monarchs, except at the end, he had, in effect, lost his mind, and his son became the regent.
Now, after George Washington's second term, and he refused to go on with another term, he would have died during his third term, wouldn't he?
Probably. You can speculate.
I'm just saying it's fewer than 4 years later.
But the way that he died, he was out riding in the sleet and snow, and he caught a chill. And things like that could be fatal back then. Because all the doctors generally did was bleed you. And so they made him weaker, that he couldn't fight it off.
Wow.
So who knows if he had still been president and not out riding his estate, at Mount Vernon in the cold and the rain and everything, he might have lived longer.
Wow. George Washington, yes, I consider him, if I have to choose our best president or the most, what should I say, the most impressive president, because he refused to go on after two terms.
Yes.
And that set the precedent that we all know. And then after FDR was elected four times, then the Congress decided we'd better put an end to this and let's make two terms obligatory, right? And I heard that that was during the Eisenhower administration, and that after that some of the Republicans began to think maybe we shouldn't have done this. We kind of like Ike.
What if?
Yeah, what if, exactly. Andy, you mentioned working at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. Many of our listeners have probably had that tour. You were one of the guides who would take people from the courtyard, that beautiful courtyard, and take them inside and then give them a talk. Tell me a little bit about the routine of doing that. How many of those talks would you give during a day and the crowds and so on?
In Independence Hall, on a usual day, there would be each ranger would do four with 85 people. And the program went about 40 to 50 minutes. And we would take them through. Of course, the big events we're going to talk about are the Declaration and also the Constitutional Convention. But we tell people, too, that at one point that little square had three levels of government on it. It had the federal government, it had the state government of Pennsylvania, and it had the city government of Philadelphia. You can imagine all that squeezed in down there. So it was pretty fascinating where they met and how they crammed in and things like that. And all the events that occurred there. All those beginning events in our history were there. And Philadelphia was the capital for 10 years under the Constitution from 1790 to 1800, before it moved to the new city named for the late president. It's interesting that Philadelphia gave all those buildings for the national government because they were hoping to keep them there. Philadelphia liked being the capital,
mm-hmm.
and the prestige that went with it, the revenue that went with it. And they thought, well, if we go all out, they're not going to want to move down to that swampland down between Virginia and Maryland. They'll stay here. But an event had happened that the Congress was determined they weren't going to stay indefinitely in Philadelphia. Prior to the Constitutional Convention, when we're under the Articles, 1783, the year the revolution is finally formally ended, there was a mutiny of American troops in Lancaster, and they marched on Independence Hall, or then it was the Pennsylvania State House, and surrounded the Congress. They wanted their back pay, and they had guns. They threatened to get artillery and such. And the Congress is huddled in Independence Hall with the state government of Pennsylvania on the second floor. And they're writing to each other these marvelous letters. I mean, two floors apart. One begging them to call out the militia to defend the honor of the United States. The other one saying, well, we don't think if we do, they'll show up. And this went on for about a week.
Who were the two groups writing to each other?
The state government of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth, and the national government under the Articles of Confederation. Hamilton is writing a lot of these letters. And Washington gets wind, because I said we're still haven't formally ended the war yet. I mean, the British haven't left. They're still in New York. He gets wind of what's happening to the government. He dispatches over 1,000 soldiers, soldiers he knew he could count on with a commander he knew he could count on, to come down from the New York area and put an end to this mutiny one way or another. And so they get down. They find out they're on the way, and this mutiny melts away. But the Congress never forgot that Pennsylvania wouldn't call out its military.
Do we know if those soldiers ever got paid as a result of that mutiny?
They probably, well, remember the money, there's an expression, not worth a continental, is paper money, not generally coin, and kind of worthless.
Uh-huh.
There were huge debts. Now, later on in the 19th century, it's hard to believe if you think about it that Revolutionary War veterans lived into the 1830s, 1840s. Mm-hmm. The last one died, I think, in 1856. Mm-hmm. Or their widows could file for a pension. And when I work at the David Library, the pension records are there on microfilm, and we can look people up. Now, some people are disappointed when they come and they're positive their ancestor fought in the revolution and, you know, they're sure there's a pension record because they lived to that time. Well, we don't always find them.
Right.
Or we find the record and what they thought they did because it lists their status, that they were private, moved up to sergeant, commissioned a lieutenant, and it puts all that in there from the claim. Well, sometimes we just find they were a private. They weren't in the boat with Washington crossing the Delaware.
And as the decades go along, we tend to exaggerate the importance of folks, particularly in our own family.
Yeah. Even when I worked at historic Rittenhouse Town for 16 years, which is in Fairmount Park, and it's the site of the first paper mill in America, Rittenhouses, a lot of them like to claim, and we estimated there were about 30,000 of them, descendants in America, that they were all descendants of David Rittenhouse. David Rittenhouse is the type of guy that if we didn't have Benjamin Franklin, it would have been David Rittenhouse.
Oh.
All around everything. And people would come in and say, I'm so-and-so Rittenhouse, and I know I'm a descendant of David. And I would have to look at them and say, well, David only had daughters. Now, unless one of your descendants married back into the family, which isn't unheard of, chances are you're not. but you're all descendants of William Rittenhouse, who was the first Mennonite and first minister in America and the first papermaker.
All right, so that many people who are truly descendants of David Rittenhouse might have a last name that's not Rittenhouse.
Yes.
So, because of the daughters.
And I've noticed that a lot of people that are descendants of David, and I've met quite a few, use the last name as their middle name. Their family named them that and all.
Right.
But, 30,000 descendants in every state of the Union. And they used to come out and do a pilgrimage, come to see the site where their family started. So I've had a remarkable career that I've been the first in a lot of my sites, the first executive director, and I got to start things and mold them. Rittenhouse Town, I was there for 16 years, and I kept saying that I wanted to finish with a member in every state. I started out with 30 charter members, and by the time I left, we had over 1,200, 1,300 memberships.
Wow.
I could never get North Dakota. And I kept saying, well, I can't leave till I get it. And when I finally got North Dakota, that's when I decided, okay, I can move on. But
what a goal, though, for you to establish something in every state.
And to restore or stabilize all the 7 original buildings. Because when I was handed them, they were a wreck.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Zellers Frederick, he is one of the stars of the American Revolution here in the Lehigh Valley. He has started Lehigh Valley Revolution Roundtable. And Roundtable, now you and I are sitting at a roundtable right now doing this interview.
Yes.
Andrew, when we go to a meeting of the roundtable, there is no roundtable.
No, we're at a square table.
Yeah, it's a metaphor. Do we just love the Knights of the Roundtable image?
I guess that kind of sharing and things like that comes to mind. Who knows? Maybe the first roundtable did meet at a round table. I've never asked that,
yeah.
But it's impossible to do it now.
Yeah, it's a great name, though. I love it. You were executive director at the Woodlands Trust for Historic Preservation and the Woodlands Cemetery Company of Philadelphia. So you have deep roots in Philadelphia and the Philadelphia area, and you're originally from there.
Yes.
So what is this Woodlands Trust for Historic Preservation?
There was the Hamilton family estate, not Alexander Hamilton, the Pennsylvania Hamiltons, completely different. And it's a beautiful neoclassical building.
Is it James Hamilton?
It's James Hamilton.
Yes. So he's the one for whom Hamilton Street in Allentown is named, which is a prominent street in Allentown. And I thought, when I moved to this area, thought that it would be Alexander Hamilton, of course. It turned out to be James.
A lot of people think that the mansion was for Alexander.
Were they related,
no.
Alexander and James?
No.
No.
But again, building to restore, which I helped work on. I didn't finish it. And I had a 55-acre cemetery located in West Philadelphia, right near Penn's campus. There's Laurel Hill is the oldest commercial cemetery, and it's a who's who of Philadelphia. Well, our cemetery was developed. It was closer. It took the family estate, and they basically did it to try and also save the mansion building. But it's like Arlington. If anybody knows this, to get back at Robert E. Lee, they put Arlington Cemetery and plowed up Mrs. Lee's gardens and everything and put the graves right up to the building so he could never return. Sort of payback. So it's at the Woodlands. The buildings, the mausoleums, the beautiful cemetery architecture are right up to the doors, basically. And they're still burying there. It's still, and that was one of my jobs, was when there was a new burial, let's say a family member either was buying a new plot or they had a family plot going back into the 19th century and wanted to be buried there, I had to go out and probe the grave for the spot to make sure we weren't hitting anything.
Oh.
Thankfully, the whole time I was there, I never hit anything.
How do you probe a grave?
With this big spear-type iron device, and you go down in the soil, and you probe around to see if anybody's there. Now, there shouldn't be anybody in the spot I'm going to because the maps are showing it's empty, but
mistakes have been made.
Yes.
You had to probe.
But the Woodlands is still, I said, doing burials and things. I'm very interested in burial grounds or cemeteries. For your listeners, cemetery is a commercial enterprise. Burial ground are usually what you think of for a church or for somebody's estate, or even farmers had a plot that they put aside for family members. That's why if you travel around, even in this area, you'll see tiny little burial grounds.
That's true. And burial ground and graveyard, same?
Yes.
Same thing.
Yeah.
And then the cemetery is not attached to a church. It's a commercial.
It's usually, yeah. Yes. Now, today, a lot of people just use them. They interchange them.
Right.
But I had to learn that because I restored two burial grounds. One actually had soldiers that fought in the 1778 Battle of Crooked Billet. That was in Warminster. And the other one was in Philadelphia. And it had a British general from the Revolution buried in it, from the Battle of Germantown.
Andy, this has been such an interesting talk that we've had today on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Our time is up. So we must bid adieu to our listeners. And I thank you again for coming in and wish you well with the roundtable of the Lehigh Valley Revolution Roundtable. If you want to look it up online,
go to our website. If you actually Google Lehigh Valley American Revolution Roundtable, we'll be the first thing that appears. If you want the website, you can go directly to that, lvarrt.org. Or as I said, you can email us at lehighvalleyarrt@gmail.com or call me at 215-904-2344.
This is Andrew Zellers Frederick. Thanks so much, you listeners, for tuning in this evening. Our time is up, and until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.